Eric.
Hey, Charles.
How are you doing, man?
I'm good, man.
It's been a long time.
It's been a really long time, yes.
What are you doing? Are you busy or something?
Yes, yeah, busy with real work, yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So we're in Building 99. We're with researchers doing great things. What's going on today?
Yeah, we're meeting here with some folks from the RISE team.
Excellent.
And maybe, you know, you have seen the Channel 9 interview at PDC, where we kind of did a big overview with Wolfram, the great leader of the RISE team. And today we have two people from the team here. Why don't you guys introduce yourself?
Hey, folks. I'm Dan. I'm a researcher at RISE. I love Haskell function programming. But today we're going to talk about imperative concurrent revisions.
Excellent.
Hi, my name is Sebastian. I don't love functional programming, but I like concurrency and parallel programming and shared memory.
Excellent. So, you know,
I don't like either, so that's good. So we have a good mix.
Wait, what? You don't like either?
Exactly. I love SQL. Guess what? Those low-level programming languages, I want to write queries.
Oh, you've become such the company man there. Yes. It's awesome. Now, you have a really interesting relationship with Dan. What's going on?
Yes, and vice versa,
of course.
Yes. That's right. Yeah, so Dan, I was his PhD supervisor. And, you know, I think we did a lot of work together in Haskell, foreign function interfaces, all the crazy stuff, you know.
And don't forget about Haskell DB.
Haskell DB, yes.
Like a precursor to Link in Haskell.
Exactly, yes.
Monads, that was a fun time.
Yeah, so. Yeah. And web programming.
That's
10 years ago, you know, we were pioneering, you know, a lot of the techniques that are now mainstream. And so I moved into a product team, and Dan stayed, you know.
Stayed pure.
Pure, yes.
No side effects.
Side effects, yes.
Excellent. Concurrency, concurrent revisions.
Yes. So tell us about it. First of all, what is a revision? And I know that from, you know, like Git and Mercurial and so on. Is there any relationship between that and what you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. That's why we picked the name revisions, because we wanted something that people could like recognize from their other domains, like, you know, source control systems, and apply it to our model. Actually, maybe, Charles, it's interesting to kind of like point the camera up there to our riseforfun.com link.
Yes.
And the nice thing is, on that webpage, people can try out concurrent revisions and other RISE technologies on the web without installing anything, so they can get a good idea after seeing this interview, you know, what's going on there.
Excellent. Can play with what they learn.
Set the kind of tone. It's like, you know, we all know concurrency is, you know, a hard problem, and I think you guys came up with a kind of novel way to tackle the hard problems, or maybe to kind of avoid the hard problems that usually when you're dealing with low-level things like locks and so on. So,
absolutely, right. Yeah. I think introduce this.
So I think one thing that you could start with is, since we talked about functional programming, and I was kidding, by the way, you do like functional programming. But one of the hard things with concurrency is the side effects, right? So we're looking at situations where we have multiple tasks in a program which are supposed to run in parallel, but they have conflicts because they have side effects. So what do you do in that situation? And, you know, the classical wisdom is you can't sort of do very much. If you have conflicts, you just avoid parallelism. Try to separate the state, try to use locks to sequentialize the access. So what we found is that, you know, if you take revision and source control, parallelism is sort of a normal thing.
And it's also a necessity, right? You cannot take a global lock and say, you know, hey, everybody out there, I don't even know you, but, you know, don't check in because, you know, I'm going to make a change, right?
So exactly. So we take this idea, which is commonplace for source control systems, and we say, why don't we do it with memory? Why don't we do it with the shared state in our application? And that's where it started. So we take, you know, revisions are like tasks, but they have this extra effect on the side effects, which is, instead of performing the side effects on the shared state, it's sort of sandboxed. It happens in your revision only.
And so how do you sandbox the, you know, the side effects? Because wasn't that one of the issues with software transactional memory, that it was really hard to kind of sandbox the side effects and know, you know, that there might not be side effects, or people might not be looking at your shared state that you don't know about?
Yeah,
so well, that's interesting. So maybe we first define a little bit of what a side effect is, right? So what we do, concurrency.
Well, then you can. I'm going to be listening very closely, because maybe you're kind of going to define a side effect to be something that's easy to deal with. So.
No. So I think with concurrent revision, there's two ingredients. So first of all, we have the idea of like forking off a revision and then joining later, and the revision is like a parallel task. But the other ingredient is it's data-centric. So we're going to say which part of your state is going to be shared and which part of your state is therefore being versioned, as we call it.
So as a programmer, you mark parts of the state like that?
As being versioned. And that means that instead of saying, oh, I'm going to lock this little part of the code, or we're going to put a transaction around this code, it's not code-centric anymore. We're going to put the annotation on the data. An architect goes in and says, okay, these particular data structures are shared, and we make them versioned in our framework.
Okay.
So these versioned parts, when you write to them or read to them, those are the ones that you each time you fork, conceptually, we make an entire copy of all the versioned state, and you get your own sandbox to work on. And when you join the revision, all the modifications you made are basically joined into the main revision.
Okay, so can we we have a whiteboard behind you. So can you kind of draw, like, can you do the kind of hello world concurrent revision?
Okay.
So let's do like a simple kind of, you know.
So suppose I have a variable x, and I want to make it versioned. So this is not a real programming language here.
That's fine. We have the whiteboard. It's great. So.
And I suppose I initialize this to 0. And now I say I have some task that has an important work to do, like assigning the value 1, which is a joke. But so let's see. Revision R. So I fork a revision. And think of fork just like a task. It could be an asynchronous task. And I use a notation with curly braces to show the work that is being forked. So say the work is an assignment, x equals 1. So this starts the task. What's different, however, we have to say when the task is done. Mm-hmm. So we care very much about when exactly does this change get checked in. So we won't just wait for whenever the processor finishes doing this. Instead, we have an explicit statement saying join R. Now, you know, what's special about this? The special thing is what you can expect about the value of X at this point of time. So usually, if you don't use revisions, if this is just an asynchronous task, at this point, X could be anything. It could be 0 or 1.
Yep.
Or worse, if you have a memory model where, you know, non-atomic updates happen. However, here, I know that I haven't joined yet, so this change is sandboxed, so I know exactly what the value of X is here. It's 0. And only after the join will it be 1. So this is, in a nutshell, what we mean by controlling the side effects.
Okay. So I like it, but, you know, I'm, you know, like, always kind of, you know, a little bit curious how it kind of really works. So what happens, say, if you have a variable that has more structure, like an array, should that be kind of, you know, transitively kind of, you know, all versioned? You know, say you have an array with a button that's on the screen, you know, now...
So I think one of the things we've done is we took a large game that was actually originally meant as a tutorial on how to program with DirectX in managed code. And this game was sequential, and we wanted to parallelize it. So one of the things you want to do, for example, is render on the screen, which wants a consistent snapshot of the entire world state, at the same time as... calculating the physics update, like where's every item going to be in the next frame of the game. And normally what people do in such a complicated situation, you have like asteroids, you have ship coordinates, you have an opponent ship, they do, for example, double buffering to do this particular thing in parallel. And this is what happens almost automatically in kind of the revisions world. And to come back to your question, in this game, there's also certain structures where you can't say, oh, I'm going to version variable X independently of variable Y, because they're really together, they're coordinates.
Yes.
And one thing, for example, that can happen is, so let's do a coordinate instead of, you know, an array. You can have like a point, right? And you have, you know, an int X and an int Y. And if I would like versions, you know, each integer independently, that's really not so great, because it could be that the physics engine says, oh, you know, X must be 1, maybe X and Y start out as 0, and then the physics engine says, oh, you know, X must be 1 and Y is still 0, while maybe the network says, the opponent player that should really take priority says, oh, you know, Y is now 1 and the X is still 0. Maybe it didn't even explicitly write to it. And if you would version them independently, you would end up with a coordinate, you know, where X is 1 and Y is 1. It's really wrong, because the opponent network update should really take priority. So it should really be X should stay 0 and Y should be 1. So what you're basically saying is these things, they have actually an invariant between them. They should be treated as one particular value. So what we allow is to version the point as one thing in itself. So you would basically, for example, declare it as a struct, and then wherever you use it, you would say versioned of point. So you would basically version the entire thing as one. And we have different mechanisms to do that. I have to say, though, we have a particular implementation currently for C#. It's a library and as a rewriter. You can even use nice attributes instead of explicit declarations like this to say these data is versioned. But in general, it's about a model. And the model allows you to arbitrarily group things together.
I understand that. I'm just trying to kind of, from a practical point of view, it's like when you say, you know, you're versioning, it's like, you know, when you do the fork, it's like you're checking out that value from the repository. But my question is, like, how deep do you kind of make that checkout? So, like, do you kind of completely copy the object graph, or do you kind of make a shallow copy?
I think we try to stay away from that. So when we first started, we thought, okay, this is like about copying objects, but it's really much more about copying fields and variables. So we actually version more from the bottom up than from the top down. So if you take, say, for example, in the game, we have an object called world, and then it has, you know, an array of asteroids and so on.
Yes.
Generally, we don't need to version all of this stuff. The thing we really need to version is the coordinates, for example. So we start at the bottom of this, you know, object hierarchy, and we take the fields and we version those. And that's usually enough. There are some cases where we need to go upwards. Say, for example, you have a collection type. We need to version the collection type itself if it's a list that is changing over time.
But in that case, if you say you have a list of, you know, like complicated objects that are kind of, you know, not value types, you know, do you then kind of, you know, copy that whole?
So we try to not reach down when we version. Okay. We try to version it independently. So in the case of the list, you would version the list object. But then the objects contained in the list, we would still version their fields. So there is a bit of a choice being made. You could design these data structures so that they're versioned at the top and then just, you know, have a deep copy happening. But I think it's, you sort of discard some of the big benefits, which is the lazy copy and write.
Yes. Yeah.
If you do this at this top level, you sort of want to do it at the bottom level.
I think that's actually an important remark you made. Like, when you fork, we do not copy, right? Just like a version control system doesn't copy everything there is. It's only conceptual.
Yes, exactly, yes.
So copies are only made if there is concurrent writes going on. So the actual amount of copying is much less than just saying, I'm going to copy everything that's versioned. But the moment you fork, conceptually, you do get your own state, and you will like read the right state.
Yes, but what I was kind of trying to get at is, like, you know, how far, you know, does the notion of, like, you know, the conceptual copy go, right? Is that the whole object graph, or, but you're saying it's like you're doing it more from the...
So we have had better experiences with, you know, thinking of memory as a flat thing, and then you version the memory locations at the bottom.
Okay.
And you can also version the pointers if you want, right? If you have a field that points to an object, you can say, I'm versioning that pointer because it may point to different objects at different times, but that's different from doing this object, you know, style of versioning, where you say, I have an object that I copy. We're not actually copying the object, we're copying the fields and we're copying the references, but not the objects.
Okay.
An interesting thing with that is if you compare that to transaction memory, mm-hmm. it's always a question like, where do you put the atomic?
Yes.
Like the easiest for me as a programmer is say, I'm going to put atomic around the entire program, but now I'm losing out in parallelism because yep. I will completely sequentialize everything. So I'm going to make it smaller to make sure there's more opportunity for parallel execution. But it's really hard to know when it's too small because now I'm wrong, right, in the case of transactional memory. So with concurrent revisions, you have something similar. I think only it's better because you have a real guide on how big you have to make it. So if I would version an entire object graph as one version thing, I lose concurrency because any write to anything in it will yes. be treated as a conflict. Yeah. So I would rather have smaller version parts where I say there's no conflict between these writes, which is better for the performance again. But again, I can only make it as small as, and now it comes, right? As long as there's no invariant holding between these yes. things that I cannot resolve in other ways. Like with the point, the x and y coordinates, it's treated as one thing. And I think that's why the bottom-up approach works well. And that's why we say it's a data-centric approach, right? The architect comes in, thinks about the data, and versions it appropriately. Which I really like. So Emery Berger, maybe you know him, he's like a scientist at the GRACE project. He always uses the one idiot rule, where he basically said, you know, I can have 100 great programmers, but there's only one idiot, and he like messes up the invariants in the program. And with sequential programming, it used to be not so bad, right? Maybe this dialog box goes wrong, but it will be caught. But with parallel programming, things are way worse. It's very hard to figure out like who was the idiot, right? And in this case, we are much stronger guarantees about invariance, and there's one architect who can like reason about it. So it gives a much better way of reasoning about your program.
But aren't you now kind of dualizing the problem by saying it's like, you know, one bad programmer can screw everything up, but now you rely on one smart programmer to make it work? I don't know which one is kind of.
Which one is worse?
Yes, yeah.
another way to look at the same thing is to think of how many changes do I make to have to make code if I decide to change the granularity.
Okay,
so with locking, it happens all the time that error locks are too fine or too coarse. You know, both can hurt us. So if we go and say, let's change the locking discipline in this program, you can't just go to one place and change it. You have to go to all the places that access that data, and you have to, you know, non-trivially think about the control structure of that piece of code, and how do I change it, where do I put the lock, and does it work right? So this is very different here, because if you want to change the granularity of the versioning, you go to the data declaration, you change it right there, and all the places that access the code just stay the same, because the versioning happens automatically in the code that accesses it. The key, the thing that changes is in the declaration of the data.
So that's an interesting question. So, like, you know, there's two places here, like on the board, yeah. where something has to happen, right? So you have to, when you declare the variable, you say it's versioned, but then also when you use it, you do a fork. What would happen if I would kind of not put the fork right there and just assign to that variable? Would you kind of syntactically catch that, or...
Yeah, I think we want you to tell us where the fork and joins are. They have a semantic meaning, so those are not the things that are automatic. I guess what I was referring to was the fact that here you don't say, you know, lock, right, when you access X. You just access X.
Yes, but what happens if I would kind of, you know, outside of the fork would assign to X? Is that an error, or is that okay? Or?
No, that's fine. It's fine. Because you're accessing X in your main revision.
Yeah, let's do this.
Maybe I'll do a little example.
Yes, we can change this example a bit, right? So what if you do x equals 2 here? What
yes.
would happen? It would actually be perfectly safe, right? I don't have to...
Oh, here it is.
So, you know, in traditional programming, this looks like a very bad thing, right? It's a data race. You have two writes. But for us, no problem. What happens is when you join... the side effects are applied, so the x equals 1 overrides the x equals 2. So you get x equals 1 again. So it's deterministic and no problem.
Okay.
Maybe there's another interesting example I wanted to show that helps you think about
the reasoning, and it's similar to this program. I'm going to write a little bit different. So suppose I like x and y, the independently versions, and they're both zero. And I'm going to, in the main thread of execution, I'm going to do a little test, right? If x equals zero, you know, then I'll increment y. And in a fork off branch, I'm going to say, well, if y equals zero,
yeah,
I'm going to increment x.
Yep.
And now you have different models where you can reason about this, right? So one of them is just currently in, say, x86 code or sequential consistent code, what could be the answer that x and y could have at this point, right? Maybe I'm using TPL, right? And I'm just forking off a task and I immediately wait for it right after. I'm going to say, well, what can be the possible things that x and y could be? I think most people here will have, maybe think about it, quite some difficulty of saying what it could all be. Right? So I can maybe enumerate it.
Yeah.
So one thing that could happen is that first this statement happens, and then there's a task switch, and then that statement happens. Yeah. So then I would get, you know, y equals 1, and the x equals 0, because the y will be incremented, but then this statement will fail, so x will not be incremented. Or maybe I'll do it the other way around, right? So I could get x equals 1, and maybe I'll do it.
Y equals 0,
x equals 1.
Yep.
Or maybe, and most people forget that, you could be halfway during this test and decide that x equals 0, then get a thread switch to this statement where you increment x, and then switch back and increment y. So you could actually end up with both of them 1.
Yep.
Many people forget this. But it's a very tricky example, right? So one solution to this is where people say, oh, you know, you're going to write atomic around it in transactional memory, or maybe I'm going to use a lock that it would be fine to. Anyway, even if I use lock around this entire statement, we still have a problem, because it could still be that if I'm here that I've first done this and then that, or the first do with this and then the other one. So I'm still going to end up with either these two. And it's still non-deterministic what's going to happen.
Yep.
But in transactional, in concurrent revisions, we're in better shape because we've just reversioned the data. Versioned int would be the declaration. And they're both independent of each other. You don't have to reason about the concurrent threads of execution. So here I can just look, say, okay, x will be 0. And I'm going to increment y. And here I'm going to say, oh, y will be 0, and I'm going to increment x. And here I'm going to join the different updates that happened. So clearly we're going to get the third here only, always. It's always going to be 1 and 1. And I think that's where the real advantage comes in, that we allow you to kind of sequentially reason about your code with the data-centric annotations.
Okay, but now let's... I love this example. This is a great example. So now let's kind of do it slightly differently. So let's not have a test there.
Tuned for the demo.
No, that's good. That's like, we should try something new. So if you don't have a test, but you say, like, in one case, you know, x becomes, you know, 5, and the other one, x becomes 7. No test, you know, there's just...
So I'll just do x equals 5. X equals 7?
Yep.
Well, then we're exactly at this program, right? X equals 1, x equals 2, I could do, you know, 5 or 7 here.
Well, but these are two forks, right? So now...
No, I had one fork here. Yeah. Okay. I kind of drew the line like this. Actually, with
we
two
could
forks,
look at two forks.
Be fine.
It's a good
to,
idea to,
yes,
to look at.
I could write it.
Let's look at two forks because there's some interesting story there to tell.
Exactly,
to,
yes, yes, yes. That's what I'm sensing, you know.
So I would do x equals 5 and x equals 7. Nice uneven numbers. So what will be the result be?
Yes.
Well, you know. Charles, you want to give it a try?
What will the result be?
Yeah.
It'll
42.
Be, yeah. 5 and 7.
Well, no, it's both there, assigned to x. You have to say, what will
okay,
x
Okay, the
be?
Result, the x will be 7.
That's right.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, that simple, is it?
So that's right.
That's correct.
Yeah,
that's correct. Yeah, it will be 7. Because it's at this point, x will definitely be 5.
assuming nothing happened here. And actually, always. Yeah, it will just be 5, and over here will be 7.
Yeah.
And so if you were to draw another fork around that, and x equals 9, the answer would be x equals 9.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
So the pattern is
at the moment you join, the rights of the child revision will be all merged in.
So if I can understand this, then this is the next great thing.
Well, but there must be some kind of conflict that you can
That's
have.
Right.
Otherwise, you don't have
conflicts.
Yes, exactly. I'm always finding conflicts, you know.
That's the interesting part, actually.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. So you want to talk about the cumulative integers?
Before we get to that, I want to say about something about this example, which is interesting, which suppose this was like, you know, a forked revision 2 here and a forked revision 1 here. So you don't actually have to join them in this order, right? You could join them in the opposite order. Hmm. So you can say, I want to join here, I want to join R2.
Yep.
And here I want to join R1. So why is this interesting? This is interesting because by choosing the order of the join, you can actually order these rights in the way you want them to be ordered.
Yes.
So in our game example, this was very cool because we had a physics engine computing local updates, and we have a network part that gets updates from the outside, and we wanted the outside updates to overwrite the physics updates. So we could simply choose the join order accordingly to guarantee that the effects happen in the right order. Hmm. So these are conflicts, like you say, right? Both of them write to the same variable, but we're actually not concerned about that fact. All we want to do is we want to order these conflicts in the right way. Now, sometimes you want to do more than that. And I think that's what you were mentioning,
yeah,
the cumulative.
Although I wanted to insert one thing.
Okay.
Is that saying, when you just said the physics simulation, local simulation in the game, we do it in one fork, and then we join afterwards the network updates that were coming in. And the network updates may write some locations,
yes,
in the game, usually of the opponent ship, for example, but sometimes also an exploding asteroid that you don't know about yet. And it should take priority, right, over what the,
mm-hmm,
physics does. So in the sequential game, it was ordered like, do physics simulation, get the network updates. If you want to parallelize that with locks, you have a very difficult problem because you can no longer give the priority between these. You cannot do them in parallel, just locking on the coordinates. But with concurrent revisions, you suddenly are able to do these things in concurrently. I think that was one of our original motivations, having these programs that are very hard to otherwise give concurrent meaning to.
So is one way to view like a fork as something that kind of executes some code and as a result kind of accumulates side effects that it needs to apply, and
absolutely,
then when you join, you kind of take the side effects and say, okay, now I'm making them visible to you?
Yes, that's
is that
perfect
a mental model?
Absolutely, yeah.
So it's like side effects as first-class values.
You could say
yeah.
that, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. It's side effects on version data.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes, with the real conflicts, I think that's what you're
yes.
getting at,
mm-hmm.
you may want to do something more intelligent than saying, oh, this the child gets the priority.
Exactly. So
that
is kind of the thing I'm curious about, because
yeah.
that is when you're doing real version control. Now, you know, I always kind of course, want my check-ins to win, because, you know, my code is, of course, always the best. But my guys in my team will say, you know, the opposite, right? So, yes, how do we deal with conflicts like that?
Yeah. So a good example is if you want to do something like aggregation. So
yes.
suppose instead of just assigning some value, I want to compute a sum of
yes.
several pieces. So no matter how I join here, I will get either 7 or 5. But what if I want 12?
Yep.
So for that, we just need a different type. So this is our idea on saying, you know, if you need a more intelligent application of side effects, then we need more information about your side effects. So by choosing a type, we actually have a built-in type, cumulative integer. So you could just choose that type, and we would know what to do in this case. But we can also break this down into, internally, we actually support something much more general. So we say cumulative, some general type, and then some function. The interesting question, of course, is what do we give to that function? Did you want to say something about that?
No, you can do the.
And
when
you do cumulative, is that automatically versioned, or
yeah.
is that okay?
Yeah.
So that's
yeah.
like
so
a,
maybe we I think the idea is instead of having the default function, which says, oh, use all the updates of the child revision, we're going to say, no, use a special function, and it does a three-way merge, basically. So what it's giving you is both the value in the main revision and the value in the revision you're joining and the original one, where it was forked at.
Okay, so just to be clear, so the three values, maybe you can kind of put a little label underneath what they are?
Yeah. So we need to say current, join, and original, I think. So this function is going to get invoked here, and it is going to get invoked here, right? So when it's called here, we have the current value is 0, and the join value is 7, and the original value is actually the value that it had when this revision was forked.
Okay.
So in the case of the cumulative integer, we can actually define this. So cumulative integer is defined as cumulative. It's nice to actually write it all down. Let me just do that. Int, and then we have a function f, right?
Mm-hmm.
And f takes current, join, and original. And what it does is returns the current plus the join minus the original. So if you want, this part is the delta. So this is the part where we take the value in the revision that is being joined at the time of the join and subtract from it the original value. So we get the delta.
Yeah.
We get what this revision did to this variable, and we apply it to the current value here. So if you do this in this case, you can compute that, you know, here you would return 7 as a result. So you get x is assigned. In this join, x is assigned. What do we have? Current 0 plus 7 minus 0, so that's, we get 7. And here we would have x is assigned. Current value is now 7 plus 5 minus 0. So we get that, we end up with 12.
That's good.
Like we wanted.
Yeah. So that's, this is very interesting. So I have two questions here. I really like this.
Right.
So one is, you know, now you have to probably be careful that function itself, you know, has no side effects or, you know, you might get your
mathematical function.
Yes, okay, so your brain might hurt if this thing is going to do weird things, right?
Yes, absolutely. So there's restrictions on the merge functions. You know, in the best case, the mathematical functions.
Okay, so that should be a real function.
It
like
should
a fundamentalist
be.
Function, like I love
a fundamentalist function.
Yes.
And it's best, of course, if you know, the library writer thinks about it.
Yes.
And another interesting one, just to help you like visualize, is like you have cumulative sets where you usually do a union. But I think the knowing exactly how you're doing smart merges
depends a lot on
the kind of
exactly.
data.
So that was my
want.
Next question. Is in some sense, these things are kind of special operators, right? Where they are kind of, you know, there's probably some theory for each type, what it means, you know, what is the change, and what is
that guy.
There's a nice algebra about that,
yeah.
You're a very smart interviewer, that's for sure. No, actually, so we have a nice semantics, and we have a paper about it, and one thing we figured out is for cumulative integers, we actually have a nice theory. So we say, basically, that if you have a abstract data type and its operations form an abelian group, this merge function with the abstract plus and minus of abelian groups is the right merge function in some particular notion.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Of course, I think maybe that was an interesting one, but in general, you want to kind of look at your data type and say, what are the operations I'm allowed to do in parallel, and how can I give a sensible merge function to it? And in practice, that can be wildly different for all kinds of things.
It becomes application-specific very quickly.
Yes, but the thing is, I think, and this is, I think, why kind of I like this so much, because the problem with locks is that locks have no clue about the semantics of your data.
Right.
But in this case, you know, obviously, as you already say, you know, if this has special algebraic properties,
now, you know, you can reason about the concurrency. Whereas locks are kind of, that's a giant hammer that you're going to just slam on it. Whereas here, you know, it's very subtle because, you know, for each type, you know, you can, intelligently kind of, you know, talk about what does it mean if there's conflict and how to resolve them. And I think that is a fundamental difference with kind of the old style of doing things.
I think you're right. Yeah. That's why we always say, you know, it's data-centric. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, like, to temper the enthusiasm, in the game example, we found very little structures that actually needed special merge functions. So the only one we use it for is currently cumulative sets, where we use union. So we basically say there's only additive operations for these particular sets that are happening concurrently, and then taking the union is the right way of resolving the any conflicts. But we had surprisingly little use for more advanced merge functions. Actually, I think we also use one cumulative integer, which we call counter.
But does the game itself have like many interesting data structures? That might also be the case, right? Usually those games are, you know, are quite simple.
The game is actually written in such a way to minimize object construction and destruction, so it has fixed size arrays and things like that.
Yes, yes, exactly.
So there's not a lot of interesting stuff going on. Yeah,
that's true. That's true.
Yeah, and so another thing. I mean, this is like, you know, like the real functional background. If you know, if you can know if these types are like, you know, I don't know, built from some kind of recursive functor or something, you know, and if it's a regular functor, a regular type, maybe, you know, you can kind of, you know, derive these things from the structure of the type.
That's definitely some interesting stuff we could do there.
That's true. We haven't done any of that yet. We've just been looking. But, I mean, it's definitely the case that it depends a lot on what kind of operations you allow to happen in parallel and how much sense the merge functions make.
Yes, and so this makes me feel much more comfortable when you said, look, there's like the one architect that comes in. But I would say it's the guy or the girl, maybe, or the person, I should say. I mean, I didn't mean to be like sexist here, but the person that kind of designs the data structure now, you know, it should come with these, you know, merge functions. And so in that sense, it's not like the architect comes in and kind of, you know, fiddles around. It's, you know, in the design of the data structures that where you put the magic. So that's a good, I think, a very good.
Or the machine, right?
Well, the machine is probably, you know, how you implement the kind of, you know, checking out efficiently and so on. But very good. So now about the implementation.
Yeah.
You mentioned like rewriting and so on. That kind of piqued my interest as well. So how does that work?
So I think what we find interesting about this is it started out as a model of concurrency for us, and we wanted to show it, right? And we did it in as a C# library because that was the easiest way to approach it. But the problem is if you declare special data types like versions of int, then suddenly instead of in your code saying x equals 7, you have to say x dot set 7. So you have to actually modify a lot of your code in order to use the new data type.
Yes, or you have to say x dot value equals 7 or something like that. Yes.
Right. You have to do some accessors somewhere.
Yes, or or you have to do some smart things with implicit
conversions.
You can do some
tricks to make the rewriting, the manual rewriting a little bit easier. But
yes, you always will show true at some point. Yep.
So one of the things we did is building a rewriter that takes your C# program plus some attributes and rewrites it into the library style accessors. So instead of
with the rewriter, you can go and put an attribute in your field. You say versioned.
That's right. And then automatically all your accessors will be turned into x.set or x.get calls. And the version, there's a bunch of attributes. So for example, you can also say versioned and then comma merge with and give a merge function. You can specify that. You can put versioned on like a struct, for example. Say version, you're going to version the entire group of fields together. We have some special attributes. There's some checking going on, so it helps you like figuring out that you haven't versioned certain things, which you might want to do. So it's read-only attributes for saying these structs are really read-only. I'm going to use them in a read-only way, which means there is no versioning necessary. It's like an optimization. So that's where the rewriter comes in. So it helps you take a more, you know, existing code base and more easily to try out concurrent revisions. And I'm at the same time, I'm working with other researchers to see if we can do a C implementation of this work. But it's still, we're still working on that.
Yeah. So, before we go there, I have a couple of more questions. So when you use attributes, like what happens if I now kind of write, you know, inside a method, you know, and I return X or, you know, so how far do you carry the kind of, you know, the type information that's a virgin int or...
Very far. So, what shall I say about it? So the rewriter is very conservative. So it will always give an error message if it cannot rewrite certain code. So there's certain kinds of code that it cannot rewrite, and it will tell you if it's unsafe to do that. So it's very conservative. It will also be the case that all your IntelliSense and everything in libraries that are rewritten still work. So it maintains your interface that you used to have. But it will change kind of the field, like the version field in there from an int to a versioned int. And like in the debugger, you can see those things. But if you look at IntelliSense, it will still show the right thing.
Yes. Let me give my quick example. Suppose I have like, you know, int f, you know, and then here I kind of, you know, inside here, you know, I want to say return x, and then here I have my versioned, you know, int x.
Yeah, so you can't have it in there because attributes cannot be put on local variables. So it should be, you know, in a field.
Okay.
If you do return x, you return like a real integer that is the current value of x.
Okay,
in that
you get just the value of the thing.
That's
it's
right.
Not versioned anymore.
You do not get the versioned as a first class.
Okay, that was my question. It's like I want to avoid this is a
That's
first
right.
class citizen. Because
yeah, no.
It's
of course. I would know you would ask that. So actually, this is one of the things I really learned from Eric, that in a language, if you want to see if it's a good design, you should always ask yourself, are these things first class? Like in C#, are functions, like methods, are they first class? And I can say yes, because I've delegate expressions. And there's many of those examples.
Yes. But
so
here, an example that's not first class is like a property, right? Okay. A property is something that lives inside a class, but I cannot have like an array of properties. So.
That's right.
Yeah.
So this is always like the, how do you call it? The litmus test of whether, you know, the design is good if something's first class.
Yes.
So Eric immediately figured out here that in the rewriter, version values are not always first class. But of course, I have a special built-in method that gives you, it works like an identity on X, and it gives you the version's representation, even if you're rewriting. So you are able to explicitly say here, you know, a version of int,
okay.
And then over here kind of have a special static method that gives you the version value of this guy.
Okay.
Like, I forgot how it's called. Yeah, I think it version... I've got how it's called.
It doesn't matter. Some
familiar,
bar,
you know.
Yeah. Exactly.
It really has like T to T in your library.
Yes.
But when the rewriter goes over it, it changes it from being, you know, it returns like the real version of X instead of X. But those are, that's only if you're, you know, I don't think people should use that. I don't think it's necessary, but hey, you know, if you want to, you can still get to it. But at this point, we mainly have to rewrite it to kind of enable people to experiment with it, see how it goes, and also to do more easily, like see what versions are all about without having to dive into the libraries in much detail.
If you use the library, you know, you're in full control. You see everything, so that can be a good thing sometimes too. But if you use the rewriter, you get it looks more like our pseudocode, so that's a nice thing too.
Yeah, and so the implementation, like the kind of, you know, the runtime support that you have for this, how big or nasty is that? Or Or so maybe not, I don't know.
I think there's a very, it was very difficult to get the implementation to do two things at once, which are lazy copy and write,
mm-hmm.
and synchronization free access to your own version, right? So when you access your own version, no lock, no interlock.
Okay.
It has to be free of synchronization.
Yeah.
But doing that and doing lazy copy and write is actually difficult. So that was the challenge.
It worked out. We did figure it out. It does mean, though, that access to version data are always more expensive than just accessing a field, right? So what you're actually going to happen, like under the covers, a little bit simplified, but basically there will be a little array. So instead of pointing to the raw value, you point to a little array, and it has like version numbers here. And then it points to like the real value, you know,
okay.
like the real integer. So in that example, there may be a version that has 5 for x, and a version that has 7, and a version, maybe the original version is 0 there. And it will all be present, because they each need to see their own values and access them independently of each other. This is the sandboxing, what you're seeing in action. And the thing is, when we do a fork, it's very cheap, nothing happens. Only on the first write, where we detect, oh, we need to maybe create an extra slot and a new version, and we're going to put 7 in there. And from that moment on, you again, it's your own local version, so it will be very fast. But it's definitely an indirection going on. So depending on your application, you may see speed-ups or not. And like in the game, we achieved speed-ups, good speed-ups, but then, you know, we started from a sequential game. So, sure.
Yes, yeah.
I think in the game we saw that if we would run this new version game sequentially on one processor, we had a 5% slowdown. And that's not too much, but it's also because a lot of the work is being done by the renderer or the DirectX. Like there's some access where you read the locations, and then you're doing a lot of matrix manipulations locally. But not on the shared data.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for applications where you kind of read the shared data and then do a lot of work with it, you're going to see good speed ups. If you're just manipulating the shared data, it depends.
Right? Yes.
There is an overhead.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so one question is like, so obviously conceptually there's like, you know, this is taken from like, you know, source code revision systems.
Mm-hmm.
So in the implementation, like if you look at Git, right, they do take hashes of everything to kind of check if the values are the same and so on. Is there also a correspondence between the implementation that you use with kind of the actual kind of, you know, revision systems for?
Hardly.
Yeah.
I think the problems turned out to be very
different.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I mean, if you want to, for example, you know, merging a source file is a totally different degree of difficulty than an integer, right? So of course we have
to. But you can kind of, you know, you allow arbitrary values, so my value can be like, you know, a list of strings too, which
right.
corresponds
to
a source
case,
file.
Maybe
so.
You would want
to
bring
yeah.
in some of those techniques, but we didn't have that situation. So
yeah.
The other difference is of course that here all the versions are in one place. So if you have a source control system, your different versions live on different machines. So immediately the implementation will look very different. Here all our versions are in one object, basically.
Hmm. Yeah.
Good thing, of course, something to kind of think about a little bit with this performance issue where you have like the indirection, which is costly. If you use locks, that's also very costly in terms of scalability. And because we have the different versions and we're very smart about how we lay this out, different threads of execution on different processes can really work completely independent of each other. So I think in general, that's why I'm being a bit vague about the performance, because I think in general, you really have to measure it on real machines. Mm-hmm. This can differ wildly.
Yes, and like we, a while back, we talked with the Spur folks here, right? So would
yes.
you kind of expect that if you would have like, you know, a very dynamic JIT that it could,
yeah.
you know, just,
so
you
this
know,
is a,
inline.
This is a very good research idea, absolutely.
Yeah.
So we believe we could eliminate much of the overhead with that. But
so
we have
I
to
believe
put that
too.
First.
Yeah. Yeah, there's lots of room for optimization. And I already have some optimizations in the rewriter, where I detect, these 10 reads happen after each other, you know, it's okay to get it once and then reuse that value locally, because I know I'm still in Zinc.
Yes, exactly, yes.
So there's I think, a lot of things.
So you're
you
doing
can
a
do.
Little bit of that kind of, you know.
A little bit, but I kind of see already there's like,
I
know no end to the amount of.
How close to zero overhead can you get? It's a very good question.
Yeah.
I think it could get very close.
Interesting. So have you tested this out? I mean, one of the great, at the programming languages panel at the Sears PDC, Herb Sutter made a great point when you guys were kind of debating about performance of one language versus the other, et cetera, et cetera. And he was basically saying, well, performance is important, obviously, especially with concurrency, but what about scalability?
Yes.
So how does this work on 64 cores, 128 processors? Am I going to see 128 times as fast as a single
process? Yes, or if I have, like, you know, 1,000 forks of, you know, the version structure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it with the algorithm itself is clean in terms of not having a scalability bottleneck.
Excellent.
But we might have, like, if we actually tried it, I'm sure we would have to tune some things. We might have some false sharing somewhere. But there's probably more work that we would need to do.
On the other hand, like, in the model, right, I think what you're saying is that the actual implementation may have false sharing. For example, that your versions are too close to each other in the cache line, so you may have to change that layout internally a bit. But essentially, it's really nice, because if you make copies of things, you can really work independently for
exactly.
a long time until you join. So the communication only happens on the join. And the complexity of the join is in terms of the number of writes that happen. So there's like, you can think about it. But at
it's,
that
it's,
point,
it's fundamentally more scalable than the idea of a lock, where you really have to sort of communicate with other processors. So that's a good thing.
So here the communication is kind of aggregated to the joins. In a way, you can compare this more with like MPI, when you think about cluster machines. And that's because the model fundamentally is kind of assuming no shared memory. It's like sending a copy to your other machine, doing the work, sending back what you've done, and merging. And we don't implement it that way, because we can do it in shared memory machines, we can do something more efficient. But yeah, and I think, especially if you look at one of the 28 core machines, I think we're going to see more and more that are... PCs are going to be like mini clusters on one board, with where the communication overhead between different CPUs, basically shared memory access, going to be very expensive. And it's going to be much better to see your CPUs as independent little processors with their independent memory. And I think our model would work well on that.
So
whether we can make the right implementation, that's still a research question. I think that's what
we're
hinting at.
So I guess, you know, what we have today is the lazy copy and write is the part where we have to be careful when we try to scale. Mm. But the concept of copying the state is extremely scalable. You could copy it and copy it again and again. You could copy it over thousands of machines. It would work. And it wouldn't work if you tried to lock, right?
Yes.
Here's actually also where, in our library, we don't only allow you to write special data types, special merge functions, like sets, which are an abstract data type. They're not, you know, versioned on a pointer level, but on abstract operations level. You can also write data types where you will also say how you copy, like on the fork, which can be important. Like maybe on a cluster machine, you array, you don't want to copy the entire array, but only parts of the view you're going to use. Or maybe you have like a really big array, and you know there will be few modifications. You don't want to copy the array. You want to make a difference array. So you basically don't copy the array and only maintain a little list of your writes, your differences, and then the merge will be much faster. So you can implement your own more smarter implementations for the particular way you're using your data type.
Yeah, so again, this kind of goes back to things like you're putting the smarts in the data type instead of just in the control flow, which is with locks, where it's completely... Mm-hmm. generic mechanism, whereas here it's like specialized for each particular data type.
Yeah, there's a lot of opportunity to put very good optimizations into the data type and then use it across, you know, all kinds of programs.
Interesting. So we've learned a lot about, especially over the past couple years, Eric, about this whole concurrency and asynchrony, RX, the new async. We've done the CCR stuff. So at some point, I think people are going to start wondering, you know, how many solutions do we have to a similar problem? And then, in this case, because you're using .NET and managed code, I'm not saying because, I mean, one of the benefits of .NET is libraries, shared libraries, right? And so, if I'm a library writer and I use your stuff to implement my thing, my data types, my structures, mm-hmm. and then I'm using await, or async await, on top of that as a composer, or Rx, what kind of things do I have to think about? I mean, what kind of things did you guys think about integrating into a different sort of model, in this case, the asynchronous model?
We're careful to not rule out any combinations. So all the choices we made, you can still use locks if you want to. We don't take anything away from you. It's really something additional that you can use. But you're right. I mean, it would be, I'm sure that if you take our thing and then something else, you would probably want some specialized support.
And I must say, Charles,
yes.
I'm always a little bit surprised that people look at these things as kind of conflicts or something, whereas programmers, we kind of thrive in this thing where there's multiple choices, right? Like, even in a single language, there's like for loops, while loops, you know, go-tos, recursion, and that's never a problem. And I think with concurrency, it's the same thing. It's that, you know, this is a complicated problem. It's even more complex than just writing sequential code, where we already have, like, this enormous choice, this kind of Swiss Army knife sure. of solutions. And so for concurrency, I think, you know, it's a little bit crazy to think that there can be one solution for every concurrency problem.
Agreed.
I think there will be more, even more than like for sequential programming.
But so there certainly is some level of redundancy because...
But that's the same thing you can also say, like I can express everything with go-tos, right? So there's even redundancy in the sequential case.
And this is experimentation.
But also, I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, we've lived with this for 50 years with that redundancy and programmers can deal with it. This is not any different. So I think we should stop asking those questions like, oh, does this conflict or how does that...
Well,
it's just all in this kind of ecosystem. And you pick maybe...
Well,
also
actually,
it's a personal thing, right? Maybe you like this
enough.
More than something else.
Maybe, though. I think
fair enough.
One thing I think what Charles is saying is like, is there real conflict that prohibit me from
Yes,
and I think
sure.
But there's maybe one example I want to say. Maybe someone writes here like print hi.
Yes.
Maybe you see my background. I should have console with write line, but I think print works for me. So you write print hi, it's a real side effect.
Yeah. So send out the missiles.
Send out a maybe like no missile on other print hi. I'm a very peaceful person. But yeah, like launch the missiles, right? If you would do this in transactional memory and you would say, oh, a fork is really like it's gonna be done atomically, and I'm gonna do this atomically. Now we have a problem, because sometimes intersection memory would execute something and say, oops, there was actually a conflict, I'm going to roll it back and then redo it to make sure it's like a sequential execution. But that means I've already launched the missiles, right? I've already printed high and I will do it again, or I will do disastrous things. So there may be side effects outside your model, in this for transactional memory, or for version data, like something that's not versioned, like the console, how do you deal with that? And with versions, concurrent revisions, we don't have a problem with that. You can do print high because we never roll back, right? It will just have the effects you already expect.
The effects of your version things are accumulated, but all the other effects remain as they are.
Yep.
And that means you can do walks, even print high in the game, we do DirectX stuff, right?
Yeah. But it does beg the question, and this is a thing that happens all the time, even, you know, like, and in my fundamentalist functional programming talk, I talk about that, you know, how these features interact, like, you know, closures with, you know, using statements. So what happens if there's an exception thrown in the fork? Things like that, you know.
We have to think about those
exactly.
things. So for the exception, we throw it on join. So we actually have a nice place to throw it because there's a join.
Yes.
It's replaying, you know, the effects of the fork, right? It's now is the exception. Except with exception, we have a nice example of using concurrent revisions without concurrency. Basically, we can instead of forking, we can kind of say run this piece of code in a special revision. And then when an exception is thrown, you just forget about it, about all its side effects, which means
if you have bad code, it leaves your state halfway modified and then throws an exception. You don't know what the invariants were or how to restore them. You can safely run it in a revision, catch the exception, and then, you know, abandon the revision, as we call it, and we will have your state still holding the right invariant.
Yes, because that is usually the problem with current exceptions, right? You know, the exception happens, and when you catch it, there's nothing really you can do, because
exactly.
there's no way to say, well, sorry, I didn't want to do what you were doing.
You don't know what I've already done.
Right? Yes.
And I think in the revision, you're basically collecting these side effects for all your version data.
And so that's what my guys think when I check in code. They always treat that as an exception, and they kind of throw away the changes.
Nice.
Carefully look at it. Yeah?
Yes. Yeah. No, they don't even look at it. Yeah. They just
like, oh, that's Eric.
Yes, that's Eric. So that's an exception. So that's even a real world example right here.
Interesting.
And so that is so. This kind of, you know, goes back to the question I asked way in the beginning. It's like, you know, which effects, you know, do you capture in that fork? So one of the nice things about like Haskell, where all the effects are kind of visible in the type system, you know, you can reason about that maybe better. So and the fork would maybe have like, you know, I don't want to use the M word, but you know.
That's right.
We should try to.
It would be great.
Add this to Haskell too, right?
Yes.
We should do that.
Yes.
There we would have a type system.
Exactly.
You can get an exact check that your program adheres completely to our semantic model, or whether it kind of goes outside it because it uses a side effect that's not versioned.
Yes, exactly.
So we would have a special version monad, like where we kind of track exactly these effects are within the version state or not. But, you know, when I think about it, one thing we haven't done yet, but what I wanted to do is, like, I can also version files, for example. Right? I'm just going to write my own abstract data type in a special way,
course,
right?
Yeah.
It's cumulative. And I'm going to version how you access files, right?
Yeah.
So it is possible to take things outside, you know, memory, like files, and
so
still version
or
it.
Or, you know, data on the web or in a database, right?
That's
There's
right.
There's a lot of examples that would be interesting. Okay.
So, yeah, it goes beyond it.
Yes. But that is the kind of the nice thing, is that you have, you know, so do you have a special interface for that? Like, you know, like... or a pattern, because you said you can override, you know, the merge function and the copy function. How do you express that?
We're working on developing that. So we have a simple interface you can inherit from a cumulative object, and you can, you know, override the merge function. That's sort of the interface we have now. But we're working on a better one where you can actually... You get a version tree. You can construct a tree of versions, and that allows you to build these differential data types where you store the difference to the previous version.
Yeah, because in some sense, this is another where I would love to have generic this thing. When you look at versions of something, right, versions of int, really you want to have like versions of t to inherit from t, right? And then, you know, you can use all the operations
from
t. So this is like a kind of mix-in thing that you want.
Yeah. We have a version. That's right.
And you're trying to simulate this thing.
It's rewriter actually simulates that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it would be so great. This is often, so often, this is kind of what I would like to have.
It's absolutely
generic.
True.
Yes.
So I think where we see, for example, to give a concrete example, is like with lists, we have this, or with sets, maybe it's a better one.
Yes.
We have a set, we have a special version set, because we don't want a version on a pointer level, we want to version the abstract operations. But now we have to duplicate all operations in sets in my object, but using our special interface.
Yes, and not only the operations, but I cannot pass that thing where you pass a set because it's now a different type. Yes, so
that's right. Well, you can now we now have I set in the
you have to be careful that it's uses the right interface. But this construct here,
if you would have some form of mixing model, we could do that.
Yeah. So you're the researcher. I have a real day job. When Andrew Kennedy or Don Simon is in town, we should kind of, you know, grill them on this question here.
Yes.
Why they didn't add that
to F sharp?
Well, no, to the generics in the
generics,
CLR.
Yeah.
This is kind of, you know, one of the things that, you know, the limitations. I mean, I love generics in the CLR. This is kind of, you know, the one limitation I often run into. Whenever you're doing these kind of, where you want to do these kind of tricky things, where you want to transparently add extra, you know, intelligence to a type. That's kind of, you know, what you want to do. It's kind of the mix-in situation.
Well, what about, like, compiler as a service that Anders is working on? There seems to be some sort of connection.
Well, but the problem is that you want this, like, generics, right, in the CLR are not erased by the compiler. So, you know, if you really want to push this through, you want to have this thing
inside the CLR.
Inside the CLR.
Yeah, because you need to be able to pass V of T to something that expects a T.
Yes.
And then, even compiler service wouldn't do it.
No.
That's why I kind of set this up as a rewriter to catch all these things. But it's also limited. It cannot handle all cases. Although, it can handle a lot.
So people need to play with this, right?
They can
play with it right on the web.
Riseforfun.com.
Yes.
And there's different tabs. And if you go to concurrent revisions tab, you can play with it online.
Perfect.
It will really run your program. You can write your own programs, send us, you know, links.
I hope that you have some kind of sandbox there that you, know, you cannot kind of, you know, erase the disk of Rise for Fun. I mean,
challenge
the hacker. Okay, your challenge
our viewers to bring down the server.
Okay, good. Oh. And I'll buy them a coffee if they do it.
Okay. You heard
the
it
first
here.
One, sorry. The first one.
The first one. Excellent.
And also on this website, there's many other technologies that colleagues of mine and Sebastian are doing in the RISE group, which may be fun.
And so the implementation, is that available too, or you have papers?
We have papers. We're in the process of getting a public release. It's not out yet, but it will be there too at some point.
Okay. And then the next time
Code
we will...
CodePlex probably, right?
CodePlex?
I don't think CodePlex now.
Oh, okay.
I think it's going to be an MSR download.
Okay. Well, we're going to have a public release soon.
Okay.
And internally, it's available in CodeBox.
But yeah, that's not.
There's Microsoft.
There's a lot of Microsoft users.
I can guarantee that.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And then the other thing is, like, you know, for future work. So you were saying, like, looking at this for native code, JavaScript. JavaScript.
Dynamic code. JavaScript.
Well, if I would have been a fan of JavaScript, I might have done it, but
there are no technical limitations of the language, right? It's just work.
Just work, yeah. And it's the same
in JavaScript. There's no types, so it's like a little bit hard to kind of, you know, attach these things to the types.
No, so you wouldn't attach it to the type, but
to the
moment you create the value, you will give the merge function. And I think the model worked just the same.
Yes.
I could do it in Haskell, I could do it in JavaScript. Mm-hmm. In C, there's somewhat of a challenge because you can. It's in a way also dynamic or untyped. So again, right, when you create the object, that's where you're going to say, and this is how it's going to be merged. And we still have some research questions there on how to be very efficient. But I think for the C implementation, for example, looking at using page protection hardware mechanisms to kind of remove a lot of the overhead.
Yes,
because
that is another thing, right? So if you can put it on the CLR, you cannot use a lot of these kind of low-level tricks where, you know, you can use the actual machine hardware or whatever there might be to speed that up.
That's
so yes. So sometimes abstraction is your friend, sometimes it's, you know, your enemy.
But for concurrency, one could argue it's definitely your friend.
Right. Abstraction? But for efficiency, it's...
For parallel performance, you can get in trouble with abstraction, definitely.
Yes. Good.
Two sides of the coin, right?
Yes.
So, example, when you treat a set as an abstract data type with additions, then suddenly when you're going to get merged and you both added something, there's not really a conflict. You know how to solve it. There's a union of these adds. If you look at it on, for example, transactional memory level, there's all kinds of pointer modifications internal to your particular set implementation, which is really irrelevant. It's a false conflict.
Yes.
Right. So I think by lifting your view of the data and being more like involved into that, you can really increase parallel performance because you remove a lot of these false conflicts and you can actually resolve them in usually in a good way.
But if you look at it too low level, you wouldn't know how, what to do with it. So I think that's interesting. I think that's where abstraction is great. On the CLR level, it's hard for us to modify the CLR, but on the other hand, the key
is to pick the abstraction that matches your problem, and then you're fine. But if you pick the wrong one, you can get in real trouble.
It's true. And the other thing that reminds me of is kind of the operation transform model, right? For like data structures where, you know, like that was, for example, used in Google Wave and systems like that where, you know about the operations, how they commute, and if there's conflicts, you can kind of, apply them in a certain order to bring to get back the kind of right version, which is kind of, what's happening there.
There's definitely a question, how would you generalize this to distributed, data storage, say, in the cloud? Very interesting.
Okay, very good. That was great. I cannot wait to go back to my office and install this stuff.
Perfect.
So thanks a lot, guys, and see you next time. And
yes, excellent. Another epic expert to expert.
Thank you.
Well, thanks, Eric, Charles, thanks to the audience. I hope you had fun.
And I hope they play with your website. So I'm going to end it on that. So go there, Niners.
That's fun.